On this episode of Skeptico, Alex talks with author and UFO researcher Grant Cameron.
We track this guy down. He turns out to be Dr. Eric Walker, who was former president of Penn State University. For 15 years, he was the chairman of the board of the Institute for Defense Analysis, which is the top military think tank for the United States military. He was the co-developer of the homing torpedo. He was friends with Vannevar Bush. He had this incredible, unbelievable background of military and connections with presidents and stuff like this. So when we go to him, we're interviewing him as UFO researchers. We're not thinking about the mind. We couldn't care less about, we had no connection whatsoever. We're talking to him and we're trying to find out the supposed UFO group that runs the whole thing is the MJ-12. We're asking him questions. So MJ-12, did you have contact with the aliens? How did the thing operate? How did you cover up the UFO thing? And in 1990, in the middle of one of these interviews, he suddenly cuts off the conversation talking about hardware, about bodies and all this sort of stuff. And he suddenly says, how good is your sixth sense? How much do you know about ESP? And the other guy goes, well, I don't really, it's not of interest to him. I don't know what's going on. And Walker says, then adds, unless you know about it and how to use it, you will not be taken in. Because the question was about who's running the group. What's this MJ-12? How many people are on the group? How are these people operating? And he says, unless you know about ESP and how to use it, you would not be taken in by this overriding group that runs the UFO program. Only a few know about it. And then in 1993, there's a related story with Ben Rich. Ben Rich was the guy who ran Skunk Works, the U-2, the SR-71, the stealth fighter, the stealth bomber. They were all developed by what was called Skunk Works. And Ben Rich ran it. And he would get a number of questions about, was this UFO technology? And he's giving a lecture in 1993. He's dying of cancer. He gives a lecture at UCLA to a bunch of engineers. He finishes the lecture. He's walking out, and one of the engineers who's interested in UFOs runs after him, and he says to Ben Rich, Ben Rich, how are these things propelled? How are UFOs propelled? And Ben Rich turns around, and he says to him, let me ask you a question. How does ESP work?
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, we're going to look at the connection between the UFO phenomena and consciousness. And the person who's going to take us through that journey is an independent researcher who I greatly admire for his tenacity and the sheer volume of work that he's done on this subject. So today you're not just going to hear first-person accounts or stories of people who've had these encounters, but you're actually going to hear about government insiders, very high-level government insiders that Grant Cameron has talked to and can provide some interesting insights into the connection between the UFO phenomena and consciousness. It's a fascinating topic, if somewhat challenging for those who are still on the sidelines of the UFO phenomena. Here's my interview with Grant Cameron. Today we welcome Grant Cameron to Skeptico. Grant is a highly regarded UFO researcher who's made some fascinating connections between what we know about the UFO phenomena and the kind of extended human consciousness we talk so much about here on Skeptico. Grant is in the process of publishing two new books and regularly blogs at presidentialufo.com. Welcome, Grant. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Alex, for having me.
So, Grant, one of the things that we like to do on Skeptico is to keep pulling on a string and follow it as far as we can. And that's what I think led me to you, because when you look at human consciousness and you start looking for explanations for things like telepathy, precognition, out-of-body experiences, and all the altered states of consciousness that serious researchers like Rick Strassman has looked into with his DMT research, or even Terence McKenna used to talk about. And it was when you try and take that in whole, and then you keep pulling at it, that string eventually leads you to bumping up against this UFO thing and the numerous reports of mind control and really consciousness bending kind of ideas that you run into. So when I heard on an interview and I heard you saying that the government insiders who really know about the UFO thing all say that you can't really understand this UFO phenomena without having an expanded view of human consciousness, well, I guess that really got me intrigued, and that's what I was hoping we would talk about today. So let me start with this. I want to jump right to the end and tell me how you came to this conclusion about consciousness being fundamental to understanding the UFO phenomena.
Okay, maybe I should first set about my sort of a little bit of my background. What happened was I got involved in 1975, just at the end of the Vietnam War, right along the Canadian-U.S. border where the U.S. Have all their Minuteman III missile silos. That's where we had a bunch of sightings. Now, but before then, I'd never thought about UFOs. I had no interest whatsoever, but I did have an interest in stuff like Edgar Cayce, research in reincarnation research. I was very interested in the work of Dr. Michael Newton. I was very much interested in near death and consciousness and this sort of stuff. But UFOs, I had no interest whatsoever. So I started in 1975 and I had these sightings. And really, the consciousness thing didn't come up for like 35 years. It wasn't until I was at a conference last year in Phoenix, Arizona, and I had filed a lot of UFO material. I had started with sightings, realized that sightings really wasn't getting us anywhere, and got into the government aspect of the documents and somebody must know about this sort of stuff. So for 35 or 37 years, I collected material and documents and all this sort of stuff.
Now, Grant, let me interject here.
Yeah.
Because you're kind of glossing over the extent of your research, which I think is phenomenal. And we can talk about the whole field of UFO research and how an independent UFO researcher like you has the guts and the determination to do this. But you're a guy who's filed how many Freedom of Information requests, and how many have been, how many have you filed, and how many pages of documents are we talking about that you've gathered in your research?
Oh my goodness. I've got over 100 Freedom of Information Act requests with the Clinton Library. What you do is you basically go to different departments. And what I had done was I tried to find who had the answer. And I figured, well, the President of the United States is supposedly the most powerful man in the world. He must know. So I would file with various libraries, presidential libraries, looking for their documents on UFOs and also on remote viewing, psychic phenomena, this sort of stuff, trying to find out what does the president know about these very sort of intricate, involved parts of reality, and figuring that at his level, he must have a better idea than you and I in the public would know. So with the Clintons, Clinton was very interested in consciousness in UFOs. Hillary was very much into, she got caught with this channeling thing with this Jean Houston in New York City, this big scandal where she was sort of talking to Gandhi and Eleanor Roosevelt and this. So they were really interested, and I filed a lot of Freedom of Information Act requests there. And I basically traveled to all the different presidential libraries looking for these documents. And it really wasn't that successful except for the Clintons. But in terms of documents, I probably have, maybe 10,000 pages of material. And a lot of it is just sort of, not the hard answers, this sort of stuff, but stuff that sort of relates. So I've collected an awful lot of material just trying to sort of put it together. And there really wasn't much of an answer. And I've had these sort of moments of sort of insight. One was when I had my first UFO sighting in 75, which is sort of just to hit you and it's like, wow, I didn't believe this existed. The other one was when I saw Dr. Michael Newton talking about Life Between Lives. He lectured, this is about 1990, he lectured in Laughlin, Nevada. I saw that lecture and that just sort of changed my life. And the third one was when we got into this real consciousness thing. This was last year in Phoenix, where all the UFO lectures, and this conference goes on for about a week, and it's like lecture after lecture for a whole week. So I listened to all these different lectures, and there seemed to be this thing where various people who were talking about consciousness. Now, it wasn't the main part of their lecture, but it was just a subtopic in the lecture. For example, Dr. Stephen Greer, who's done the disclosure news conference trying to expose all the high-level government witnesses, he talked about this consciousness thing, that this is at the basis of the UFO interaction with the Earth. And David Sarita and all the various abduction researchers who would talk about this mental telepathy thing that was going between the abductees and the aliens, that nothing happened by word of mouth. It was all telepathy. And so this is sort of a subtopic, but it wasn't until the last lecture. And the last lecture was given by Colin Andrews. And Colin Andrews is, for people who know the crop circles, the famous crop circles in England, Colin Andrews is the key researcher. He started in 82. He is the top researcher on crop circles. And he gave this lecture, which was called Circles, Consciousness Circles, or Circles of Consciousness, or something like that. And it was one of these mind-altering things that when I heard his lecture talking about the fact that the aliens were sort of making crop circles, but they were also controlling the people who were hoaxing crop circles. And that was his whole lecture, was that there was 80% of the crop circles are hoaxed, but that the people that he talked to who are hoaxing the crop circles were talking about some sort of interaction, some sort of force that was getting them to make certain types of circles. And so his thing was that the aliens control the whole thing, the real circles and the hoax circles. And it was this whole idea that the aliens were sort of in control of what is going on, that they're part of the cover-up and they're part of this sort of interaction with the human race, that they're sort of leading us along. And I got this sort of an instant insight for 35, 37 years of research, where suddenly everything sort of fit together, all these stories that I can sort of relate to, you, these little things that I've known for years and years and years, everything suddenly fit together.
Now, Grant, hold on, because there's a lot going on here. And I want to back up for a minute and say that, you know, this realization that you had, that these pieces fit together, I think is kind of interesting, and I share your perspective on it. From the beginning, these accounts have always had this element to them, this extended consciousness. You know, we had Stan Friedman on this show a while ago, and this show that we're doing today, Grant, will be only the second show that we've ever done that touches on UFOs. And again, our approach to it is to look at the connection between consciousness. But Stan Friedman, of course, you know, did pretty extensive work on the Betty and Barney Hill abduction case in 1950.
Yeah.
And he's not that interested in consciousness. So he immediately brought to the table, well, yeah, this guy pulls off the road, has no reason or explanation for why he's done it, and then is communicating telepathically. So you have both the mind control, why would this guy who's really kind of fastidious and would never get in the dust and the dirt pull off on this gravel road and get outside of the car? And then two, how did he know this stuff without communicating? So from back in the 50s, there's these reports. So I just want to emphasize what you brought up, that, you know, this has kind of been hanging around there for a long time, and no one's really put the pieces together. But now that I've kind of interrupted you, I want to get you back on track.
Okay, well, let me clarify that compared to there's a part of the UFO community who believes very deeply in this, the abduction stuff. And if you listen to the two top researchers were David Jacobs and Bud Hopkins, and they talked about the fact that after 1975, we knew everything we knew about UFOs in terms of sightings and really nothing. You had to get inside the craft to know what was going on. And they would talk about this interaction between abductees and the aliens. But they made the connection was that other than that, all the people who've talked to aliens, it's all hoaxes, like back to the 1950s. The Betty and Barney Hill thing did not start until 1962, when they started to make this thing public. And before then, for example, when they were first abducted, they went to NICAP, which was the biggest UFO group in the world at the time, and it was headed by Major Kehoe. And Major Kehoe said, this is nonsense. Little aliens do not abduct people on the roads. And he basically would not touch this thing with a 10-foot pole. The same as J. Allen Hynek, who was probably the most prominent UFO researcher in the world of all times, same thing. He said, stay away from abductions. It's no good. Don't go to abductions. And a lot of people avoided that sort of interaction thing. And one of the things that people left out when you get Hopkins and people like this who are talking about the abduction thing, they say everything else is nonsense. And I started back with the work of Wilbert Smith, who ran the Canadian government UFO program. The Canadian government investigated this thing and from 1950 to 1954. And there's a top secret memo. It's a legitimate top secret memo. It was declassified by the Canadian government. And in that memo, Wilbert Smith, who was running the Canadian government UFO program, writes to the deputy minister of the Department of Transport, giving a report on UFOs. And he said,
Grant, let me interject here, because this is really an important memo for folks who are still on the skeptical side of the whole UFO thing. And what I want you to do is talk about, in real simple terms, who Wilbur Smith is and why, which you just did. So let me say this. How did Wilbur Smith come to write this memo? Why was he down in D.C.? And why should we believe what's in the memo? And along the way, of course, you have to tell us what's in this memo.
Okay. He was called a senior radio engineer. And after the program was shut down, he was actually promoted to the communications, sort of the head of communications. And he worked at Shirley's Bay, which is outside of Ottawa, the Canadian capital. And basically, it's the NSA of Canada. He ran Radio Ottawa, which was trying to pick off Russian communications. He was in charge of all the radio frequencies, AM, FM radio frequencies. So when FM radio came in the late 50s, he would negotiate with the Americans on radio frequencies along the border. You get this frequency, we get this frequency. But he also controlled the military frequencies and the intelligence frequencies and handing out radio frequencies to these people. And he was given the job to research the flying saucer thing. He was very interested. He said that he was down at a conference in Washington, D.C., and a couple of famous UFO books had come out, and he started to ask questions, and he said he basically got these confirmations. And so he writes back to the Canadian government, and he's reporting on what he learned in at the Canadian embassy in Washington, D.C.
As part of his job. I mean, he's reporting that this is what he's supposed to be doing. It's also his passion and his interest, but this is a real guy in Canadian security in the U.S., in D.C., and asking around, hey, what about this UFO stuff?
Yeah, and he's going through the military attaché, which was attached to the Research and Development Board in the United States. The Canadian military liaison guy was giving him a lot of this information, and the Research and Development Board in the United States was in charge of the hydrogen bomb, all the weapon research. This was the key sort of research and development aspect of the American military. So he's getting this material, and he reports back the basic things that UFO people have always, for 30 years, have talked about this UFO thing. He says flying saucers, he was told flying saucers exist. It's the most highly classified subject in the United States, rated 2 points higher than the hydrogen bomb. This was written in December of 1950, 2 years before the first hydrogen bomb was detonated. So this is before the hydrogen bomb, and he's saying this is higher classification than the hydrogen bomb. And then he says that there's a small group headed by Dr. Vannevar Bush, who was the scientific advisor to Roosevelt during World War II.
The go-to guy, Vannevar Bush, is the go-to guy for everything, right, at the highest level.
Every,
so atom bomb,
all,
nuclear.
All your atomic bomb, your jet engine, proximity fuse, every major development during World War II was headed, the scientific aspect was headed by Dr. Vannevar Bush. And so Smith is saying he's given the job to figure out this flying saucer thing. So Smith is going back and saying flying saucers are real. He was told by American officials, and he doesn't say like some guy, he's saying American officials are telling him that this is for real and that if we have anything to exchange, they're willing to exchange. And so for 30 years in the UFO community, I, along with everybody else, quoted these 4 points. But the very next line in the document, everybody has left out, and the very next...
Now, hold on. Before you get to that next line, let's do a little cliffhanger here. Who was the intended audience for this memo? When does this memo become public? And what other evidence do we have that this was completely legitimate? What other confirmations do we have from other individuals that this did in fact happen the way that Smith said it did?
Okay, well, It was written in December 1950 to start with. It wasn't declassified. Stanton Friedman was actually one of the people who forced it to be pushed out, but it wasn't fully declassified until 1978, I believe it was.
So almost 30 years later.
That this thing was declassified. And what happened was that when Smith was dying, he was dying of cancer of the lower bowel. He knew he was dying. He told his wife, get rid of the files. So the files were held by his oldest son, and they were then moved to a researcher in Ottawa who knew that this memo existed because Smith had a copy in his personal files. So there was push from these researchers who knew what was in the files to get the Canadian government to declassify the documents. So when they finally declassified the documents in 1978, this top secret document became public. Now, the way the government got out of it said, well, he didn't have rights to declassify or to put top secret on it. And, you know, they tried to find different ways to sort of invalidate the document, but it is a valid document. It is in the Canadian research libraries, and nobody denies that it wasn't written, that it wasn't top secret. They're just sort of playing on the edges of whether it should have been top secret to start with. So this document is there. Smith writes it, and he's writing it to the Canadian government. And
then we have confirmation from a U.S. official who says...
What happens is Stanton... tracks down, there's an interview that Smith does at the Canadian Embassy with a scientist, Dr. Robert Sarbacher, who in the 1950s was a sort of a consultant to the U.S. military, to the Research and Development Board. And in 1983, this after the document becomes public, Smith's personal files become public, and this interview, this handwritten interview with Dr. Sarbacher, which gives part of the material, not all the material in the top secret memo, but some of it. And Stanton decides, well, let's see if this guy's still alive. He finds the guy in Florida. He's still alive, Dr. Robert Sarbacher, and he talks to Robert Sarbacher. Did you give this interview to Wilbur Smith? And he says, yeah, I recall giving this interview at the Canadian Embassy. And it basically, he says, well, what was the background? He said, well, I, as one of the consultants in Washington at the Navy section, I was called into a series of meetings at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base where they had a crash flying saucer and they were briefing a bunch of high-ranking scientists at the Research and Development Board. I didn't have time to go. He was working on the Canadian Dew Line project. He didn't have time to go. But he started naming off all these different people to Stanton who had gone. And he named off Dr. Bush, of course. He named off von Neumann, who was sort of the initiator of the computer, Dr. von Braun. He named off a number of high-ranking scientists. Then he named off one scientist who was still alive, and that's kind of a long story. Dr. Eric Walker, who was the former president of Penn State University, and we actually go to him, and he confirms a lot of this stuff. So Sarbacher does give confirmation for the fact that he did tell Smith that it was the most highly classified subject in the United States, that flying saucers were real. All we know is we didn't make them. We don't know who made them. And so it sets the basis for the fact that Smith has not just connections with people in the United States, but he has connections with the U.S. government. And in fact, his son confirmed to me a rumored story that at the end of his life, his father had told him that, yes, he had actually gotten access to the crash flying saucer. He was showing crash flying saucer outside of Washington, D.C., and he did see the bodies. So Smith was at this very high level classified area where he was actually interacting between the U.S. and the Canadian government.
And we should add that Wilbur Smith is someone that you have researched, a fellow Canadian that you have researched extensively. So you spent several years collecting as many of his notes and documents and interviewing family members and friends. So it's really been a major interest area of yours. Is that correct?
Yeah, yeah. And I have all his files, which are 4 DVDs full. It was a lot of material.
But I want to come back and unravel and get back to the next line in the memo.
So in 1950, when Smith writes this memo to the Canadian government describing what he's been told by officials in the United States, he talks about the UFO stuff, which everybody quotes. In the very next line, everybody leaves out, and I left it out for years too. He said, I was further informed that U.S. authorities, and you got to get that, U.S. authorities are investigating along quite a number of lines which might possibly be related to the saucers, such as mental phenomena. And I gather they are not doing too well, since they have indicated that if Canada is doing anything at all along the lines of geomagnetics, they would welcome a discussion with suitably accredited Canadians. So he's basically saying that they've got this connection with mental phenomena, and if there's anybody inside Canada who's working on it, if you get cleared to talk on a classified level, we're willing to talk to you because we're trying to figure this thing out. And the key part of this whole thing is that in 1950, no matter what anybody in the UFO community wants to say, there was no discussion, none whatsoever in any literature, that there was any interaction between the aliens and human beings. The first interaction that's publicly been made known was when the contactees, which were people who were talking to the blondes, appeared in 1952. George Adamski, there was a bunch of them in 1952 that started to say, we're talking to aliens and we're having meetings with them and sort of stuff. Smith writes this memo 2 years before. There is no discussion in UFO literature about an interaction, whether it's talking to aliens or whether it's a telepathy. And so the important part of this whole thing is that in 1950, Smith is saying the American authorities already know that mental phenomena is part of this flying saucer phenomena. The American government, who will say right up to today, Obama released a statement just a couple of months ago saying we have no evidence, don't have anything. And here's Smith saying in a top secret memo, which is not discussion about whether this is a legitimate memo, 1950 is already saying the American authorities know about the importance of mental phenomena associated with the flying saucers. So they've known the mental phenomena aspect right from day one.
So Grant, that's fascinating. Now, make the connection for us for MK Ultra. Tell people a little bit about what is MK Ultra, particularly because it happens up there in Canada.
Yeah. Okay. The whole MK Ultra and all the related programs didn't become public until the mid 1970s, and it became public in a big scandal in the United States, and Richard Helms had been involved. And when it first became public, it had been discovered immediately that the vast majority of the documents had been destroyed. And this was basically the CIA working on mind control and on trying to work on this aspect of using the mind as a weapon of war, interrogating people, finding out what the Russians were doing, and all this sort of stuff. And when you look back at this thing, there's this very significant meeting that takes place. Smith writes his memo in December of 1950. And one of the people that's mentioned in the top secret memo is Dr. Oman Salant, who was the head of the research board, the military research board in Canada. And Smith mentions him, that he's briefing him as well. He's writing it to the Department of Transport, but the Defense Department, this Oman Salant, is involved.
I guess what I'm asking is, don't we have to look at that a little bit differently now that we understand the Smith memo and the next line that you talked about? Because I understand the Russian connection, you know, and we had Joe McConnell, who was psychic spy number 001 at Stanford Research Institute as part of the Stargate program. And we interviewed him, and we understand that there really was this perceived threat from the USSR. But I think what you bring to the table here is that there is this other element going on, which is this UFO, is an understanding that the UFO phenomena is related to these mental phenomena. And I think that that plays into this as well. But maybe I'm taking it too far. Would you agree with that?
Well, I don't think we really get the UFO connection till later. In the 50s, 60s, 70s, I don't think you get these pieces falling out, like the MK Ultra, that whole scandal about the fact that the CIA was interested in the mind in the military aspects. But it's not until later when I get these other pieces that pop in that were always in my head, that that sort of fit in, where it says the UFO connection is really important. And the one was, I mentioned Dr. Robert Sarbacher, and he was giving material to Wilbur Smith. And when Stanton interviewed him, he says, well, who was there? Wasn't anybody alive? You're mentioning all these guys who are dead. And he said, well, there's this one guy from Pennsylvania. He was real arrogant. He thought he knew everything. He attended all the meetings. And we tracked this guy down. He turns out to be Dr. Eric Walker, who was former president of Penn State University. And for 15 years, he was the chairman of the board of the Institute for Defense Analysis, which is the top military think tank for the United States military. He was the co-developer of the homing torpedo. He was friends with Vannevar Bush. He had this incredible, unbelievable background of military and connections with presidents and stuff like this. So when we go to him, we're interviewing him as UFO researchers. We're not thinking about the mind. We couldn't care less about, we had no connection whatsoever. We're talking to him and we're trying to find out the supposed UFO group that runs the whole thing is the MJ-12. We're asking him questions. So MJ-12, did you have contact with the aliens? How did the thing operate? How did you cover up the UFO thing? And suddenly in the middle of one of these interviews in 1990, and he's interviewed for about 8 years. I'm sort of running this team of researchers around the world and I'm not talking to him. There's people who say, I can get Walker to talk. Okay, here's his phone number. And what we do is we take all the interviews that are done with him, we put them in a book. And in 1990, in the middle of one of these interviews, he suddenly cuts off the conversation talking about hardware, about bodies and all this sort of stuff. And he suddenly says, how good is your sixth sense? How much do you know about ESP? And the other guy goes, well, I don't really, it's not of interest to him. I don't know what's going on. And Walker says, then adds, unless you know about it and how to use it, you will not be taken in. Because the question was about who's running the group. What's this MJ-12? How many people are on the group? How are these people operating? And he says, unless you know about ESP and how to use it, you would not be taken in by this MJ-12, this overriding group that runs the UFO program. Only a few know about it. So, and we saw the interview and I put it in the book. We published the book in 1990. We're about to republish the book. We put it in this book in 1991. We never mentioned it in the book. We never brought up this mention of the fact that ESP was involved because it meant nothing to us. We're into the hardware and the bodies and all this sort of stuff. But he mentions this in 1990. And then in 1993, there's a related story about a conversation that takes place with Ben Rich. Ben Rich was the guy who ran Skunk Works, the U-2, the SR-71, the stealth fighter, the stealth bomber. They were all developed by what was called Skunk Works. And Ben Rich ran it, and he would get a number of questions about, was this UFO technology? And he's giving a lecture in 1993. He's dying of cancer. He gives a lecture at UCLA to a bunch of engineers, and he's talking, and he says he says, we've got the technology to take ET home. He gives this lecture. He finishes the lecture. He's walking out, and one of the engineers who's interested in UFOs runs after him, and he says to Ben Rich, Ben Rich, how are these things propelled? How are UFOs propelled? And Ben Rich turns around, and he says to him, let me ask you a question. How does ESP work? And the guy says, well, I mean, it means that all points in time and space are connected. And Ben Rich turns around and says, that's how they work. And so here's this top guy in U.S. military research who's saying ESP, that's how UFOs are propelled. So you get these connections years later that basically put this together.
Grant, let me layer something else on top of here that I've heard you say that it's changed the way I think about this whole topic. And I don't know to what extent I fully agree with you, but that's that you look at the UFO phenomena through a national security lens rather than as a scientific phenomena. You insist that we look at it from a national security perspective. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, let me clarify that. I wrote an article. It's on my website. If you go to my website, on the right-hand side, you'll see articles. I wrote an article on it used to be called the 64 Reasons the Government Decided Not to Tell You the Truth. The number one reason is because it's classified. It's simply, this is military technology. If we can develop things that can fly around and nobody can capture them, if we can get this mind technology where we can go and grab the head of the Soviet Union or Russia and get into his head and give him messages like that's happening with abductions and be back in Washington for lunch. That's the kind of technology we want.
And let's slow down and talk about that, because we have to look at that from a historical perspective. Hey, that's always been priority number one for any nation state. Is not only defense, but offense. Whoever has the best weapon wins, and wins decisively. Yeah. And their ideology and their whole culture advances. So this is really priority one for any state. And we don't have to look back too far in our history for evidence of that, right? So you can't really make that point strong enough that this would be the top priority for any kind of new technology.
Yeah, it's called military lead time. That if you have a weapon and you suddenly decide to use it in a war, how long did it take you to develop it? If it takes you 60 years to develop it, you suddenly use it in a war, the other side can go to their leader and say, well, we're going to fight this off, and well, how long is it going to take? Well, about 60 years. You know right now from the Iraq war, I mean, you can wipe out everybody else's tanks in about two weeks. I mean, if you have a weapon, it's over. But there's the other aspect of this whole cover-up thing, the 64 reasons. The one is the government is covering it up for their reasons, military security, and the fact that, you know, we're paranoid and the Chinese and everybody in the world is trying to get us, and we have to have this security and defense to protect the United States of America. But the other aspect is the aspect that connects with the mental phenomena, and that is that the aliens are covering up as well. The aliens could land on the White House lawn anytime they want. They could come on to the TV and announce themselves. They don't. And there is a cover up by the aliens. And that's what I say is that this whole, if you take a look at what's happening, and what I say the UFO community has missed is that in the UFO history, if you look, it is like the aliens are turning the pages of a book, and there's just one thing after another. 1947 to 1952, they do nothing except fly around and let people see them. 1952, they start to talk to people. 1961, they start abducting people. 1967, the cattle mutilation stuff starts. Does not start before 67. 1982, the crop circle starts. That you get the aspect of people starting to remember various parts of abduction stuff that they didn't remember in the 60s. They're remembering different parts now. And it's almost as if the aliens are just slowly turning the pages of a book, and we are going through the way they want this thing to be unraveled. They could have told us 1947 was going on, but they're just slowly taking us along a path. And that's what I think is so important about this mental aspect thing, is that it's, if you take a look at the UFO history and you look at stuff, you see that the things that are happening now did not happen. I was in 1975. It was a completely different world. The things that happened then don't happen now. Ground trace, for example, they used to hear stories about aliens landing, ground traces, little aliens walking around with little rods outside their crafts. It does not happen anymore. There are no reports. It used to be hundreds a year. There's none. It's like the aliens are taking us down a path, and this mental phenomena is part of what they're doing. And there are some very incredible stories inside the UFO community that show that they are doing this kind of stuff. For example, let me give you one. The Rendlesham Forest story is one of the top stories in UFO, and that's a story about a craft landing at a U.S. Air Force base in Britain, and the people going out and touching the craft and seeing this stuff and all sorts of reports and stuff like this. And Peniston, James Peniston, who was one of the main people who was at the site, gets near the craft and he touches the craft, and he's been interviewed and he talks about this message that he gets, and it's a message that comes in zeros and ones. They later put the message together. It's a 14-page long message of zeros and ones, and he gets this message and it has this interpretation. I don't want to get any interpretation. He's interviewed about a year and a half ago, and he was asked this 14-page message of zeros and ones. You had this message. You had to put it down. You got it instantly in your head when you touched the craft. Could you do it again? And Peniston said, yes, I could write the message again. 14 pages of zeros and ones, and he could actually redo that message. Not just an ordinary message from an alien. Incredible message that is 32 years later. He can still remember the message every dot, every zero in that message for 14 pages. That's an incredible thing. And that's the aliens giving something to us that is not just a message, it's an incredible message. Or this story of the most famous abductee in UFO history now is Stan Romanek. And a lot of people will say this guy's a hoaxer. One of the things that he's incredibly known for is getting these very complex formulas, mathematical formulas that he just suddenly gets up in the middle of the night, starts writing these formulas under hypnosis. He writes these very complex formulas. And one of the formulas was a formula by one of the top people who was involved in the mind control and the remote viewing program, Dr. Hal Puthoff, who ran the SRI program for 30 years or 25 years for the CIA. One of his formulas, he's gotten out of the mind aspect, the remote viewing, and he's gotten into the UFO thing, into zero point energy. One of the formulas that Stan Romanek writes is one of the formulas that had only been published one time in the world, and it was a formula by Hal Puthoff on zero point energy, and this abductee gets it. So you get these not just ordinary messages, you're getting these things as if the aliens are putting this in here and actually taking us along a path and giving us stuff that we would not have gotten on our own, and they are leading us. So that the cover, they're covering it up, but they're gradually releasing it. And now I'll say the disclosure, when we finally find out what's going on with UFOs, is when the aliens tell us.
Yeah, and boy, there's just so much there to pull apart. I just can't leave that without touching on one point that I think you make, and that's that to understand the government deception and the government cover-up, one of the things you bring to the table is to say it doesn't have to be masterminded if you just look at it from the national security lens. You can have a lot of people that can just be set off to do a task that's purely national security, and it can wind up looking very nefarious from a high level, but when in fact they're just like, hey, we have to make sure that we're on top of this kind of thing. But let me leave that for a minute, because again, there's a lot to pull apart there, and what I really want to do is circle back around now and talk about some of the things that you're talking about from these other glimpses we're getting of expanded human consciousness and see how they might fit together, because then I think we can't really even talk about the aliens versus us and this time versus that time. I think all those things start to get a little bit fuzzy. And the person I'd bring into this discussion, I mentioned earlier, is Joe McConnell, who we had a chance to interview a few months ago, and of course is psychic spy number 001. And when one of the little anecdotes that he told that I thought was just fascinating is, so he sits down with Hal Puthoff at Stanford Research Institute. And as you just said, Hal has been hired by the CIA to figure out this remote secret spy thing and how we can spy on the Russians using psychics. And his file, he looks over at his file that they unsealed that is totally secret. No one can get into it. And there is a copy of Raymond Moody's Life After Life book. And the reason why this is relevant is because Joe McConnell has had a very profound near-death experience while he's an intelligence officer for the United States in Germany. And in this near-death experience, he leaves his body and is having an out-of-body experience and then goes to heaven and encounters this being that, for any other way we talk about it, is God, and makes this connection at this level of consciousness that is clearly way above our level of consciousness, and gets this mental download. Again, so you're talking about the Rendlesham Forest case. You look at near-death experiencers and or many other spiritually transformative experiences that have been reported throughout time, whether they're Kundalini or Christian experiences. But often there's this download of information that just gets whoosh, put into the brain, and sometimes they can't even repeat it when they get back. But there is this higher order of consciousness. So don't we have to start trying to make that connection too, and try and see how the whole thing fits together.
But it's still a big package of unknowns. I mean, you sort of get the connection that you can get these downloads, that the consciousness is an extremely integral part, that it may be the whole thing, that consciousness, like the, right. the Eastern philosophies,
maybe
that the consciousness is the basis of the right. whole thing. We, in the Western world, science, and I have some problems with science, I always say science is not there to solve this problem for us, because science is basically, if you take a look, there are John Alexander, who's, you know, this sort of high-level military guy who's gotten into the mind and into UFOs and this sort of stuff. He always mentions the fact that in the National Academy of Sciences, the higher the level you get of science, the more they disbelieve any sort of phenomenology, whether it be UFOs or mental phenomena or remote viewing and stuff like that. And at the National Academy of Sciences level, only 4% of the people believe in phenomenology. They have nothing to do with it. And so basically you have like atheists, like right. phenomenology atheists, that in the UFO community always wants the scientists to sort of run the program. And I say, no, keep them out of it, because they're tainted by sort of a Christian religion where everything is like a material, that you have a God with a beard right. and we're going to go to heaven with streets paved of gold and stuff. Right. And I think you have to move away from that into sort of an Eastern philosophy thing. But as I say, I'm one. You might have Colin Andrews. You have Stephen Greer. You have maybe a dozen people in the UFO community who believe strongly in it, that the consciousness is a basic core of this phenomena. The rest of them would say, this is absolute nonsense. This is crazy. This is nuts and bolts. Don't talk to me about this consciousness stuff. It's nuts. It's not well received in the UFO community. It's a very new aspect, and I'm saying in the UFO community now, we better start taking a look seriously at this. As nutty as it might have appeared in the 1950s, this is what's going to give us the answer to what is going on here. If you start looking at the nature of consciousness, the nature of the universe, is it really a material universe? How does it work? This entanglement properties, all these advanced physics ideas. But we are very, very far away. I don't think we really understand very much.
Right. Well, of course we don't. But, you know, Grant, it's interesting what you say, because when you take even a small step back from the UFO phenomena, as we've talked about here, it becomes obvious that consciousness and this extended human consciousness or alien consciousness is central to it. So it's again, funny that there's this controversy within your community about a phenomena that jumps right out at you from all the different angles that we've talked about. And I'll tell you from my perspective, and we've been at the extended human consciousness work of others through this show for a number of years, that the next step is the spiritual aspect. And the parapsychologists, let's say, the parapsychology and the psi community that we've talked to a lot here, if I could roll in also the near-death experience science community or the out-of-body experience science community, all those have a similar blind spot in that they want to look at consciousness and extended human consciousness, but they always have this kind of soft spot for scientific materialism. And they wind up saying some of the same things that you have, and that, well, we haven't understood it, or we don't understand it completely, and all the rest of that. And I really have been kind of pushing things in another direction, and that's that all the reports of this extended consciousness we talk about very quickly get to this spiritual connection. And I'm not talking about it from my personal spirituality. I'm just talking about it as a core part of the phenomena, a core part of the experience. I mean, Joe McConnell, who is deep, deep in this stuff, he doesn't talk about his near-death experience as being just a mental experience. He talks about it being a spiritual union with a consciousness that is of a higher order and, from his perception, is of a much, much, much higher order. And, you know, that may be offensive or upset people who are strong atheists, and as you point out there, which is really more of an anti-Christian thing. But I'm not talking about anyone's personal spiritual beliefs or personal religious beliefs. I'm just saying this spiritual aspect is clearly a core part of this phenomena. And I just wonder if anyone in the UFO research community has gotten there. I think John Mack was kind of headed there, but John Mack, of course, a Harvard psychologist who got interested in the abduction phenomena and did a lot of research in talking to abductees and came to the conclusion that it was psycho-spiritual. So where has that whole line of research gone within the UFO community?
Oh, absolutely. There's a division there, but what I always sort of point out is it comes down to the male and female thing. If you go to, I know if you've been to UFO conferences, but if you go to UFO conferences, you'll see a real sort of separation between men and women. Men are into the hardware, they're into the technology. How does this thing fly? Where's it from? And all this stuff. And if you take a look at women, they are into the spiritual aspect of the thing. We got to take a look at what the women are doing, what the men are doing, and that it is a unity of the two. But right now, it's still a separation. You have the men who are into the hardware, and you have the women who are into the sort of the spiritual, the experiences of people, and they will go a lot farther in looking at the abduction experience as being this sort of almost a spiritual experience. But if you talk to men, you'll talk to Robert Collins and his abduction experiences. It's they're evil. They're here. We have to try to fight them off. And so you have this, the men who are basically saying it's an evil type thing. It's a national security thing. We got to fight it. And the women are at that sort of a higher level. And there is a real division inside the UFO community. The reality, I think, is going to fall where you describe it, that it is going to be more of a spiritual experience. We're sort of influenced by the government, that everybody's an enemy, and it all comes down to us versus them. So we see the aliens, you see all the latest UFO movies. It's always the great Americans bringing freedom and democracy to the world, fighting off these evil aliens who are trying to take over the world. Whereas that's not what I think it is. I mean, if the aliens wanted to take over and destroy us, they could have done it 100 years ago. Why would they wait? It is not. It's more of a spiritual development of the earth at their pace as they unfold this thing for us, and that women have already caught on to how this works.
One last area I'd like to get into, and it's been great talking to you. I appreciate all the time you've spent on this. You obviously have not only a passion for this, but you've matched it with a deep, deep knowledge, and I really respect and admire the way that you've gone about researching this and filling this unexplainable void that we have out there.
Yeah.
In terms of why an independent researcher like you has to be filing hundreds of FOIA requests and gathering and publishing this data while we have this huge apparatus in the media that is just completely blind to it. But let me get off of that pedestal, and I want to talk about the psychedelic connection, because another guest we've had on this show is Dr. Rick Strassman, who was at the University of New Mexico, and as far as I know, is the only researcher who was given permission to study the effects of DMT on subjects. So he gathered up a bunch of students there at New Mexico and gave them rather high doses of DMT, and they saw not only aliens, but fairies and other independent entities that seem to operate in this other realm. And of course, this work with psychedelics is mirrored by many other researchers, and anyone can go and Google Terrence McKenna, and you can get all sorts of interesting ideas about the connection here. But what are your thoughts on what the psychedelic community and the psychedelic research and what we found out? What's your thoughts on how that might connect to all this?
I don't really know. I have really not thought about it, except as you're describing it, it's sort of like the small percentage of reality that we really understand, that when you get into these different states of mind, that everything sort of changes. I really don't have much of an opinion, except that it just shows how limited our knowledge of reality is, that we really are just starting out, and that you're probably going to need another, 30 years of experiments and somebody getting an insight on a new experiment that will sort of nail down what's actually going on there.
Right. What I think a lot of folks don't realize is that the materialism in science mirrors the materialism in our culture. So our materialistic society and how we're materialist, and how George Bush says, don't worry about the Iraq war, just go shopping. The connection is real. It's not some abstract connection. It's real, because it's only in a world that you construct where it's just about matter, it's about goods, it's about survival, that you're able to rationally do these things, to gather things and then go bomb other people. If you have this expanded view that says we're all somehow connected, and we don't have to understand what that means, but we're all connected, our idea of time is not what we think it is, all these things, as soon as those things break down, you can't run a nation state. Sure. You certainly can't go bomb other people and do all the other crazy stuff. You can't deny basic water and health and the things that we do to all these people so that we can. You just can't run the game. And I'm not saying that's necessarily good or bad, because, hell, I have too many advantages to say that. I banged my head against that. When I first got into this, it was like, gosh darn it, why aren't these scientists looking into this? And if only they knew, Yep. And it's like, hey, the whole process, the whole system is orchestrated so that anyone who has that awareness is kicked out from the beginning, because you can't have those yahoos running it and pointing and saying the emperor has no clothes, and that, you're coming at it from a whole different perspective and saying, hey, the UFOs are running the show. And I come at it from another perspective and say, hey, as a non-religious person, as a non-Christian, God is in control. God is clearly in control. When these near-death experiencers die, they tell you they see God. You just can't get past that. And it's funny, because I've talked to a bunch of near-death experience researchers, and they've said, I just had a great interview with a guy who I think is one of the real champions of that, but Melvin Morris. And we had this discussion, and he kind of came to the same thing. He says, you're right. I have to play around with that concept, because imagine this. So he's an outsider. So he's a near-death experience researcher. He's a physician, pediatrician, Yeah. Teaches at a hospital, but he's still an outsider, right? He's ostracized because he's researches NDE stuff.
Yeah.
But even within the NDE community, he's an outsider if he goes and says, well, yeah, they do talk about God, and we have to figure out what that would mean, that higher consciousness that we would then call God. We have to factor that into the equation. We can't just waffle it and say, well, yeah, maybe we're all connected in some way. That's not what the evidence is. That's not what the best evidence is telling us. The best evidence is telling us that there's something pretty close to what we've always been told is God. Yep. And what all these different religions and wisdom traditions and Native Americans and Aborigines have always pointed to and said, no, there's like a real, real high guy up there, and that's God, and that's more than all this other stuff. So that's where I'm coming at it from, and that's just a hard thing to get over, given the way we've kind of orchestrated the whole deal that we have here to work inside of our materialistic world.
Yeah, you just got to transfer that sort of God thing is find a way to make a buck out of it, and then people would accept it, or take the threat out. Because in terms of, I've mentioned numerous times in the UFO community, it's the, if you take a look at the interaction between abductees and aliens, it is actually direct ESP, direct mind-to-mind interaction. There's no, like, all the ESP experiments that have been run by humans have all this noise to signal ratio that's sort of bad at the best of times, and here it's like there's absolute no noise whatsoever. There's this interaction. So if you look at that, that's a major threat to say governments. I mean, if you're if you can read somebody's mind, I mean, what do you do if you're a politician now running for the 2012 election? You stand up to make a speech. Everybody knows exactly what you're thinking. There is no scam anymore. And that to me, to an establishment, is something like let's keep this out of here. This is not something we want.
Right. But if I can make one more point and drill into this, I'd be interested to get your opinion on this, you know, and that's that. Again, and I just can't stress this enough, so I'm going to stress it one more time. I'm not coming at this from a religious perspective. I don't have any agenda to push in terms of any religion or even any kind of spirituality. I just come at it from looking at the facts. And the facts are the abductees don't talk about the aliens as being God. They see this level of consciousness that is greater than them, but they don't see it as God. And God here is just a placeholder. People are going to freak out. They do all the time whenever you say God, but a placeholder for a very, very high consciousness. And the people who have the Kundalini experience, who have the spontaneous prayer experience, who have the near-death experience in particular, they do talk about quote unquote God. And I don't see too many people really making that differentiation. They just go in and say, oh yeah, well, the abductees had this ESP experience or this out-of-body experience, so there must be some, it's like the aliens are God. Well, you know what? I don't know if that's true or not, but the data that we do have suggests that it's something very different and that people know when they're encountering something like God and they can differentiate when they're encountering something like an alien consciousness.
I mean, it's at a lower level. It's like a lower frequency or whatever. It's the same sort of experience. Like consciousness would explain everything. I mean, from the top, from God all the way down to the most basic material things, it's all still consciousness. It's sort of different vibrations or different levels. And so your ESP that's happening at the alien level is a higher level than what we have talking to each other on the earth. And I started out, I mean, that was my experience before UFOs. I was at university and that was my major was religion. And I did the near-death experience thing. I went to talk to the different chaplains and asked all the weird questions of the various chaplains, you know, like, did anybody ever walk out? You know, was there any miracles? Did anybody ever walk out? Did anybody ever predict their death? Did it tell you exactly when they were going to die? And all these weird things that surrounded death. And there definitely was a religious aspect of the thing that's different than the UFO interaction between aliens, that when you're talking, and I went to chaplains rather than to ministers, because chaplains, there's no sort of garbage right, there. Right. It's basically they're dealing with dying people all the time. They're not there trying to, you know, recruit you to the Roman Catholic religion or the Lutheran religion or whatever. It's basically they're dealing with dying people, and that's who I wanted to talk to, because it's like when you come to death, there's no more crap. Everybody's telling the truth. Everybody's basically telling you the way it is. And there was this religious atheist. I had numerous ones where, did you ever have an atheist? Did they right. ever come back with a near-death experience? And it still came down to this higher God thing, which is, as you say, is different than the alien thing, but it's the same sort of, we're just looking at different levels of this consciousness thing, that it's all consciousness. But in the UFO community, people do not understand that. They're still at this basic level of nuts and bolts, us versus them, military aspects, and there is a difference, but it's still consciousness. It's whatever level you're at that is explaining the same thing. And once you understand consciousness, you can sort of put them in the different levels and explain what's going on. But I don't think we're so much in the material world that consciousness really has not been researched very much by anybody. And that's the basic problem we have.
Great. Hey, Grant, tell us what's going on, what's coming up for you in terms of books, appearances, anything like that?
Well, I'm redoing this book that we did in 1990 that basically tells a story about Wilbur Smith and going to the States and Dr. Eric Walker. And we go into Area 51, sort of the updated story of Area 51 that gives the reality. And that's being republished. Richard Dolan is going to republish that
Oh, great.
Within the next 3 or 4 months. But basically, I'm giving the consciousness lecture. I think this is, as I said, one of the three top periods of my life. The one was when I had the UFO sighting. The one when I saw Dr. Michael Newton speak about life between lives. And the third was when I had this consciousness thing last year at the Phoenix. So I'm giving this consciousness lecture. I'm giving it first in England in beginning of August, then in Philadelphia at the end of September. I'm giving the consciousness lecture. I'm giving it at the Phoenix at the UFO conference next February in Phoenix, Arizona, and then I'll be giving it in Orlando in May. So it'll be the same lecture, and as I will, it'll be a more developed lecture as I go along. But this is the lecture I'm giving now. I think it's the most, as I'm saying, it's the most important thing that the UFO community now, I think, has to learn, is that this is a critical thing. If you want to understand what's going on and understand the fact the government has always known this, you better start looking at this aspect of consciousness, because we have entirely missed the boat. We are floundering around, still looking at sightings and tracking sightings and stuff. I think we have missed one of the key aspects of the whole phenomena that would give us a lot of the answers as to what's going on in UFOs, and that is the consciousness thing. So it's a consciousness lecture, and Colin Andrews is going to follow me in London. He's giving the consciousness lecture. He knows mine. We're exchanging information on consciousness. He's going to give the one on the crop circles again about consciousness and crop circles, and I think it's, you'll see it slowly move into the UFO community. It'll be fought by a lot of people, but this is, as I said, this is something the UFO community has missed, and I'm going to start talking about it, because to me it was a revelation. I was missing it as well.
Great. And so for more information, people, presidentialufo.com.
I appreciate your time and your interest. It's strange to see somebody outside the UFO community take this interest, and I'm glad you did, and I hope that our two communities sort of have more interactions, because I think we have something to offer each other that will help each of us understand what the other side is doing, and help us understand the answers we need in our field.
Great. I couldn't agree more. You know, it's this never-ending process of opening yourself up to more and more of what's out there. And it's always a little uncomfortable, you know, and I'm sure some listeners to this show are a little uncomfortable tiptoeing into the UFO field, but gosh darn it, yeah. You just have to follow the stuff wherever it leads. And that's really our charter, isn't it? We just have to go where it takes us. Well, thanks so much for joining us today. I just am delighted with the way this came out, and I hope people enjoy it.
Beautiful. Thanks, Alex.
Thanks again to Grant Cameron for joining me today on Skeptico. There's so many, many topics that I'd like to discuss as a result of this interview, but I'm going to tee up just two of them here. First, what are we to make of our government's apparent knowledge of expanded human capabilities when it comes to consciousness, ESP, mind reading, and the rest? What are we to make of that, given the public scientific stance that's being promoted by that same government? What is really going on there? And secondly, really the big question, what does this knowledge about what we've encountered with UFO consciousness mean in terms of the larger story of human consciousness and spirituality? It's a topic we touched on in the interview, and it's obviously the big question. What does UFO consciousness have to do with NDE consciousness, have to do with psychedelic consciousness? How do they all tie together? And of course, we're not going to have any definitive answers, but we can maybe kick around how we can nudge a little bit closer to putting some of those pieces together in a way that's meaningful. I'll look forward to hearing what you have to say on that. And the best place to do it is, of course, on the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com or on the Skeptico forum, or you can always just send me an email or drop me a note on my Facebook account. By the way, of course, when you're at the Skeptico website, be sure to check out all our previous episodes of Skeptico that you can download for free, and most can read the transcript for free on the website. I've also started publishing YouTubes for the interviews. They're really not a lot more than just the audio with a few graphics overlaid on the top, but at least it gives Skeptico some exposure to folks who search on YouTube. Well, that's going to about do it for today. I have a number of interesting shows coming up. I'll be getting to them just as soon as I can. Until then, take care and bye for now.